Extension number 8727.
Colonel Short, Reel 2.
Go on. But we now had to see what had happened after all this. So the British officers of the regiment, we all dismounted, walked over the ground, shooting the wounded horses simply as a mercy act. That was all we could do about it, and before we returned to camp. Our casualties were comparatively few because of the fact that the Arabs didn't dare to attack the cavalry, which was massed with heavy firepower, you see. But we lost two valuable British officers. One was a machine gun officer who was killed defending his gun, and the other was one of the squadron commanders, both very badly missed when we next dined in our mess. They had to be buried, of course, next day. There was now a lull after this engagement until the Turkish force decided to attack our position in Shaiba. And they pushed this attack quite vigorously. Even the operating table in the hospital tent came under fire, not on purely casualty bullets, but there it was. And fighting went on for about 2 days, 3 days, and they'd had enough, and the Turks withdrew. The job now was to get all our casualties, sick and wounded, back to headquarters in Basra. Now, the command in Basra had requisitioned large numbers of bellums, which are gondola-like boats, driven just by poling, you know. Now, the country between Basra and Shaiba, quite unexpectedly, had heavy rain, which you didn't really expect. And the whole of that country was now a shallow lake, stretching for the 12 miles between Shaiba and Basra. So all the casualties and the sick and wounded were put into these bellums, and as senior medical officer to accompany them, I called myself Admiral. Admiral. Unqualified. And we pulled this, there must have been about 100 of these boats, this armadoes, pulled back to Basra, took ours, and were met by an officer there who afterwards, we don't know why, was decorated. Well, that finishes that now. During this attack by the Turkish force, the cavalry was no longer used as cavalry. We were dismounted and just took part in the general defense as infantry. As it lasted about 2 days, 3 days. I was lying under a mulberry tree when my servant, a wonder soldier, brought me food there, quite nonchalantly, under fire. He didn't seem to mind. And everything remained quiet after this attack. Now, about this time, it became obvious that so many problems were now arising that it was necessary to organize a central laboratory staffed by officers of different kinds who were experts in different degrees, different things. And this was put under the command of Colonel Christophers, an officer of my service, Indian Medical Service, who was already a worldwide figure as a scientist. Do you want to know the names of some of the other officers? The other officers with under Colonel Christophers were myself, Short, as protozoologist and malariologist, Bassett, a chemist, Stevenson, and a bacteriologist, an entomologist whose name I don't remember, and also a Turkish prisoner who had been trained in Paris, and we utilized him in the laboratory as a bacteriologist. One minor task I had was a complaint by an officer in command of a detachment of Sikhs on the docks. These Sikhs were very disgruntled, worked badly, and when I spoke to the officer, he said, "Well, these men at home are accustomed to taking opium. It's almost just like smoking a cigarette for them. They can't get the opium here." So I approached the officer in charge of supplies and said, "I want some opium for this regiment, for this detachment." And he said, "It's against orders to supply opium to anybody. But if you make out an indent for treacle, I'll see what I can do." So I made out an indent for treacle and in exchange got 3/4 of a pound of opium. That problem settled. The next thing was to visit an isolation camp situated on the bank of the river opposite Basra. I went to examine this and found it's composed of 2 very large tents under the sole command of a non-commissioned British sergeant. And I found I probably had the only microscope in the force except anything in the British hospital. And I set to work to examine these 2 tents, examined every man, had blood slides from him. I found a large number were suffering from relapsing fever, which was a spirochetal disease. You could see it in the blood. And another lot, not so many, who were suffering from typhus, which is a much more dangerous disease. So I got the man to separate all the typhus cases into one tent, the relapsing fever cases much more numerous into the other. And I said, this arrangement must be maintained. On my next visit, I was furious to find both tents equally inhabited. And I said, what have you done? You had my orders, keep them separate. He said, we were visited by a general. And I told him what you had said about it and what my orders were. And he said, nonsense. He's only a junior officer. He doesn't know what he's talking about. So he had them all equally disposed in the two tents. What could you do? I reported the matter, of course, but heard no more about it because I came on other duties. At first, the central laboratory were dealing with ordinary military supplies, questions of food, the quality of the rice for the troops, quality of the military equipment, their uniforms, and all that sort of thing. And a major part of our work was to carry out what we called malaria surveys. For this, as a malariologist, I had to travel all over the country of where the operations were going on or were going to go on. And there, you collected at villages, towns in the country, at each place, all the children which you could. I used to distribute sweets as a means of collecting all the children. And these children examined each one separately to see whether it had an enlarged spleen or not. Because the number of children with enlarged spleens was an indication of the amount of malaria in that district. And this took you into villages, towns, everywhere. Arabs and marshes were very interesting among the marsh Arabs. Now the Arabs living separately like that in the marshes and in the desert are noted for their hospitality. I came on a single hut in a marsh occupied by an Arab, his wife and some children. The hut was divided in the middle by a partition across the tent. It was a reed hut, really. And behind this was a wife and some children. And the front, where we went in, the Arab and I were together. We sat down on the floor, and he offered me some food. Well, as he did this, through this partition, you couldn't see, but you could hear and be heard. And I heard one of the children say to the mother, will there be enough left for us afterwards? So I hastily said that I didn't require anything, I'd already fed. But could hospitality go further than that? That's only by the way. The central laboratory at first was located on a ship. We had the whole ship as a laboratory. It had previously been a research vessel in the Indian government. The crew remained on the ship. The officers were all in cabins, and we had the laboratories as well on the ship. When possible, we all dined together. I gave you the composition of the lab. On one occasion, an entomologist was ahead of us and started off to have his dinner. He had one mouthful of soup, and then he gave a grunt and he rushed out of the cabin to the rail of the ship to spat out his mouthful. So I called for the cook, and I was told that the cook was not well and he was behaving queerly. Colonel Christopher, our commander, now appeared, and we all went down to see this cook in his bunk. He was lying on the bunk, babbling away. I took hold of his hand with the idea of feeling his pulse, and without any hesitation, he leapt up off his bed, got his legs round my neck, had to be pulled off. And we had to actually tie him up. And we took him across the river, deposited him at the Indian Military Hospital. Diagnosis unknown. When we returned to the ship, we visited his cabin, his bunk, and we found there some cubes of opium, and these were very similar to cubes of soup which were issued in the rations. And we found that he had made this soup himself, probably under the influence from the opium tubes. But we couldn't have been poisoned, because the first sip would have been some beastly thing that was. And that was that. Next day he was returned to his very chastened shelf. But it was a funny intro. When it has got pushed back beyond Baghdad and Mosul, life became rather dull, because nothing was happening behind the front lines, except the there was a dramatic episode happened in connection with the central laboratory. The staff, the lower down staff were all Indians, and they were very disgruntled, because they said, why don't they send us back to our homes in India? The war is over, the armistice is over. However, they weren't, and it led to more and more talk, and eventually became a very nasty conspiracy. This conspiracy was that the British officers are all located in the upper story. We must be sent home. What we'll do is this. One night, we'll go up to the upper story when the British officers are all asleep. They'll all be murdered, and then the lab will be set on fire. This was low-class Indian thinking. And they said, there'll be no officer, there'll be no lab. Surely when we'll send us back to our homes in India. But these people were on the lower floor. The upper floor was occupied by the British officers, with one exception. In a corner room of this upper floor, there was one member of the the staff who was a Sikh. He occupied this room, and from the lower floor where these conspirators talked, a chimney led up into the corner room where the Sikh was. And by listening there, he could hear everything that was going on down below. He learnt the whole thing. Conspiracies to be carried out. He told the commanding officer, who informed the police. And the police managed to get an agent provocateur among the into the councils of the conspirators. And the result was, they were all arrested. Beyond that, I don't know. The name, it was a police matter after that, and but that was what happened. But it could have been a very nasty thing indeed, because it could have been done. War concerning the Indian Army, at least, where the Gurkhas were not concerned. Now, I had no connection with the Gurkhas here. All my military work was with the cavalry. But I happened to be visiting one day a hospital ward where all the patients were Gurkhas. There was no accommodation for them. And they were distributed in rows on the floor, on their bedding. I couldn't think what was happening, because these men, quite happy as usual, Gurkhas generally are, they were busily engaged slapping themselves. Closer observation, I found that they were killing flies. And they're great gamblers, these Gurkhas. And I found that there was a competition going on. Each man beside him had a little heap of corpses of flies. And the winner of the number of flies after a given time won the game. That is what they were doing. Now, in the early days of the expedition, supplies were very limited before the whole thing got organized. And in one ward, a surgical ward I had charge of, there were no anesthetics available. And all the minor operations I had to do without any anesthetic. You could only do things like extracting bullets from limbs and that sort of thing. And that was, they didn't seem to mind very much. They took it all very well. Well, my story is more or less finished, but I don't know whether you want to hear some of the more amusing incidents. Well, I told you that the laboratory was on a ship at one time. One day, the entomologist, who in private life was a padre, one morning he appeared at the breakfast table in great distress and said, "I can't have any breakfast." And I said, "What's happened?" He said, "My teeth." And he was in the habit of leaving his teeth in a mug of water at night. And he woke half awake, half asleep, took this mug of water and emptied it out of the porthole window. And he saw his teeth, his artificial teeth, outlined against the sky, going into the river. That was his trouble. He spent the next day dredging for them without success. The other story, also amusing, is not exactly a drawing room story, but I may as well tell it to you. I think it's in the book, as a matter of fact. In all the military stations where British troops were concerned, there used to be a more or less official brothel, which these men used. It was a sanitary measure, because otherwise they'd have gone into the bazaar and got anything. But under this system, the brothel was carefully managed, and the girls were regularly examined and so on. In the cantonment hospital, I won't mention where it was, because then you could tell the regiment. But I had charge of the brothel as a medical officer. And one morning, when I got to the hospital, I was told there had been a fracas, a riot last night. The brothel was more or less attached to the hospital, one end. And during the night, some soldiers got drunk and they chased one of these girls through the ward of the hospital in the middle of the night, making a nuisance. Well, you couldn't have that sort of thing going on. So I reported this matter to the officer commanding the troops. And he said, I can't have this sort of thing happening. I'll get hold of the men concerned. I thought no more about it. And some days after, I got a letter in the morning, a note, asking me, would I attend a parade of the regiment of the company, to the company strength there? I didn't know what for. And when I arrived, they were all drawn up and in a long line. All the men seemed rather amused, they were smiling. Then the commanding officer said, I'm going to find the man responsible for this thing. He must be here. All the troops are paraded. And then he had this girl from the brothel, commanding officer, the girl, and I walked down the line, these troops, and they were looking like this. Could hardly, of course, nothing happened. She failed to identify anybody. But that wasn't the whole story. Afterwards, I got a letter one morning, put on my table, and this is why I'd gone to see this commanding officer, you see. This is a complaint written by one of the girls describing what had happened that night. And I made inquiries. I found it was quite an accurate account of what had happened. But the funny thing was the letter. It was, the address at the top was the Bullring, we'll say Benares just for the sake of it, the Bullring Benares. And then, dear sir, you are the commander of this brothel. We are entirely under your care. Nobody else is able to look after us. And we look upon you to save us from this sort of behavior in future. Well, to that effect. I'm so sorry, I lost the letter, which I've always regretted. And it ended up, your obedient prostitute, Miriam. Well, that's all I have to say. There are lots more, but I can't.
Well, thank you very much.